Chapter 2. The Essential Revolution. The Lord said, "Here, Subhuti, someone who has set out in the vehicle of a bodhisattva should produce a thought in this manner. As many beings as there are in the universe of beings, comprehended under the term beings, egg-born, born from a womb, moisture-born, or miraculously born, with or without form, with perception, without perception, and with neither perception nor non-perception, as far as any conceivable form of beings is conceived. All these I must lead to Nirvana, into that realm of Nirvana which leaves nothing behind." Talking about producing a thought makes the Bodhisattva sound a bit like a conjurer producing something out of a hat, which gives a false impression of how the thought in question, the thought of enlightenment, the bodhicitta, does in fact arise. "Should make arise a thought" might be a better way of putting it. The text proceeds to exhaust the content of the term beings by recourse to traditional and not exclusively Buddhist enumeration of all the different possible classes of beings, even up to beings that dwell in the realm of neither perception nor non-perception, which in terms of meditative states corresponds to the fourth formless dhyana. The expression "miraculously born" can be misleading. People in the West usually think of a miracle as representing the direct intervention of God into mundane affairs, suspending the operation of natural conditions. But this is not at all the sense in which this kind of birth is miraculous. As Konza rightly notes, miraculous and or apparitional birth, that of gods, demons, beings of the Antarabhava and never-returners, is said to be much more common than the other modes of birth. Bearing in mind that moisture-born refers to all the kinds of small-scale life-forms that are not subsumed under the other two categories, the miraculously born make up a class far too numerous to be labelled miraculous under any sensible interpretation of the word. Konza offers apparitional birth as an alternative, but this suggests something insubstantial or ghost-like, which is clearly not the case here, except perhaps with actual ghosts or pretas. The word aupapatika literally means just appearing, or better, spontaneous, though not in the sense of being causeless. It really means that these beings appear at a more advanced stage of development than is normal in the case of those born from a womb or an egg. They just appear fully formed, without going through conception, gestation, infancy, and childhood, but also without being called into existence by some divine miracle. For example, in the Antarabhava beings are supposed to appear spontaneously, with a fully formed subtle physical body and fully developed subtle sense organs. Beings without perception is Konza's translation of asanyasata, the class of devas sometimes known as the unconscious gods who appear in the Pali scriptures. Presumably these gods are unconscious because they occupy a particular realm, but do not direct their attention towards the realm itself as an objectively existing thing, rather in the same way that beings in this world who are absorbed in meditation might not be conscious of the world which they, in a sense, inhabit. The term asanya literally means non-perceiving. It is questionable whether unconscious means quite the same thing. Maybe these beings are just gods who do not take much notice of things. The Buddha speaks of the Bodhisattva leading all these classes of beings to that realm of Nirvana which leaves nothing behind. This, the Nirvana without substratum, is attained by Buddha upon his Parinirvana, when his physical body dies. Konza notes, without comment, Chandrakirti's image for this sublime condition. A city which, after all the criminal gangs in it have been executed, has now itself been razed to the ground. This suggests that Nirvana is something like Hiroshima after the atom bomb. This represents a kind of brutal nihilism that needs to be questioned, even when it comes from the pen of so distinguished a commentator as Chandrakirti. In speaking of the Tathagata, the Buddha said, "It is not to be said of him that he exists after death, does not exist after death, or both, or neither." So Chandrakirti's simile is quite misleading, although it might be much more appropriate if the criminal gangs were all to be converted and the whole city was to become a Pure Land. After all, when we are trying to halt the wheel of conditioned existence, we are also engaged in ascending the spiral of the unconditioned. That Chandrakirti felt able to use this kind of language at all says a lot for the innate positivity of the Indian people. And yet, although innumerable beings have thus been led to nirvana, no being at all has been led to nirvana. And why? If in a bodhisattva the notion of a being should take place, he could not be called a bodhi being. And why? He is not to be called a bodhi being in whom the notion of a self or of a being should take place, or the notion of a living soul or of a person. Self is Atman, being is Sattva, living soul is Jiva, and person is Putkala. All these terms could refer to human beings. As a result of one's encounters with so-called beings, one forms the notion, the concept, of an objectively existing, unchanging, identifiable, separate self or being, or living soul or person. The notion is a wrong one, inasmuch as it does not correspond to the facts of the situation, whether in the Hinayana terms of Dharmas or the Mahayana terms of Shinita. It is not that the facts of one's experience are in question. The notion of a being is simply one's wrong interpretation of the facts of one's experience. This is the fundamental insight of the Diamond Sutra, that beings do not exist, we do not exist. This is easy enough to say, of course, but a staggering idea actually to take on board. We are being told that our present mode of perception, of consciousness, even of being, which tells us I am I, is false. We may be able to take in the idea that beings do not exist, that even we do not exist, on an intellectual level, but can we take it seriously enough? Are we prepared for this blotting out, as it would appear to be, of our present experience? Are we prepared for what is sometimes called spiritual death? If we are not, if there is no spiritual death, then there can be no spiritual rebirth. If we are prepared to expose ourselves to this radical insight, we will find that it is worked out in the sutra through various fields of application. According to Dr. Konza, the Buddha establishes the realization of emptiness according to three perspectives: ontological, psychological, and logical. Ontologically, the doctrine of emptiness means that no such thing as a separate entity exists. There is nothing which is truly and really and absolutely separate and itself. We are in the habit of chopping reality into bits, distinguishing one thing from another. This is this, that is that. Then we start preferring this to that. We choose this rather than that. We stick to this and reject that, which is where we go wrong. And this is not just the Diamond Sutra, but the whole of the Buddhist tradition speaking. It is not that we are meant to see things as one, exactly, reducing all things to unity, or somehow blotting out the difference. It is rather a question of seeing things as being in some way interfused. For an illustration of this idea, we may turn to the Gandaviyuha Sutra, in which the reality of things is compared to the intersecting of beams of light. If you have rays of light of all different colours, flashing in all directions, crossing and crisscrossing, what you find, obviously, is that one beam of light does not obstruct any of the others. They all shine through one another. They are not lost or merged into one great light. They all maintain what you might call their separate individualities, but they offer no obstruction to penetration by other individualities. They are all mutually interpenetrating. In reality, things can be perceived neither as being chopped up into mutually exclusive bits, nor as being absorbed into a unity. When we see into reality, we see all things as interfusing and interpenetrating one another. There is both individuality and unity, neither obstructing the other at the same time. Even the traditional categories of Buddhist thought cannot be excluded from this way of perceiving the world. Buddhist terms like the Buddha, the Bodhisattva, merit, wisdom, and so on, do not refer to any fixed or absolute or final entities. They are just devices, upayas, to help us on our way. Their value is provisional, not ultimate or absolute. This, in the end, is how the ontological application of the doctrine of emptiness of self, shunyata, works out. Psychologically, the doctrine of shunyata means not being attached anywhere, not standing or settling down anywhere, not depending or leaning on anything, or taking anything as a support. After all, if entities do not exist, there is nothing to lean on anyway. The problem is that it is very hard to realize this, because it is not what we actually want. We want to depend on something. We want to settle down somewhere, anywhere, particularly as we get older. This desire is not just material, but psychological, even spiritual. We want to find some cozy corner where we can be all warm and secure, like a little bird in its nest high up in a big tree, and say, "Well, here I am, fixed up. I've settled down. Nothing can shake me." But of course it can't quite be like that. It just isn't possible. Sooner or later, however safe and secure everything seems to be, our supports are going to be rudely pulled out from under us. There is only one way out of the suffering that is built into the system in this way, according to the Diamond Sutra, and that is to develop an attitude which does not settle down, and which does not try to establish itself anywhere, which is free and flowing and spontaneous. This does not mean being impulsive or irresponsible. It is the spontaneity that arises freely and creatively out of a realization of the truth of emptiness. Finally, from the standpoint of logic, the doctrine of shunyata shows rational thought being transcended. The basis of traditional logic, both in the East and in the West, is the law of contradiction, which says that a thing cannot be A and not A at the same time. That is, it can't be, say, both black and not black. The Diamond Sutra, however, says, "Oh, yes, it can. A thing is itself because it is not itself. It is what it is because it is not what it is. It is A because it is not A. It is black because it is not black." Logic is abrogated. Reason breaks down, unable to cope with ultimate reality. Reason is very useful indeed in the affairs of everyday life, but it is no use at all where ultimate reality is concerned. If we want to soar through the void, we must leave reason and logic far behind. Not easy to accept, perhaps, but all too easy to misunderstand. There is no question of submerging into irrationality. Transcendental wisdom develops through the transcending of logic, through rising above reason, not through sinking below it. The central and crucial paradox of the Prajnaparamita is here, at the very start of the Diamond Sutra. The Buddha says that the Bodhisattva should firstly resolve to guide all beings to Nirvana, and secondly realize that in reality no being exists. There is clearly a contradiction here, and it is clearly meant to be a contradiction, and it is meant to express the very essence of the Bodhisattva ideal. Usually we think of compassion as being directed towards individuals, or perhaps groups of individuals. We see particular people suffering, and then our compassion, or at least our pity, arises. But the Bodhisattva does not perceive individuals. The Bodhisattva perceives the truth of selflessness, the truth of non-individuality, the truth of shunyata, or emptiness. It is out of this perception, this realization, that the compassion of the Bodhisattva arises, a compassion which we perceive or interpret as compassion for individuals. But how does a Bodhisattva, without any notion of beings, actually go about leading them to Nirvana? The simple answer is that he or she doesn't, or rather that he or she only appears to do so. For example, on a much more ordinary level, you might see somebody helping others, being generally useful, thoughtful, and considerate, and conclude that this person has a definite idea of being kind and decent towards other people. But they might have no such notion at all. It might just be their nature to behave in this way. In the same way, on another level entirely, Bodhisattvas help people freely and spontaneously, without having any definite notion of helping people, without indeed having any notion of people at all. Bodhisattvas are essentially free of self-consciousness in the less positive sense of the term. The Bodhisattva vow has permeated through to the very depths of their being, and fulfilling it is simply what they like to do. From their point of view, there is nothing special about it. Indeed, in the sense in which people who have not taken it understand the vow, there is no need for it. It is the arising of the bodhicitta, the will to enlightenment, which defines a bodhisattva. Then the bodhicitta finds expression in the taking of the vow and the practice of the six paramitas. The vow is a starting point, but it isn't something the bodhisattva leaves behind in the way that a literal starting point is left behind. It's a thread that runs through the whole of the bodhisattva's career. A non-bodhisattva may have to think quite consciously and deliberately about taking the vow, but this is just preparing the ground for the actual taking of the vow, which happens quite spontaneously. Not only is the vow in no way a vow in the ordinary sense of the word, it is also difficult to think of it as the act of an individual as such. A vow to lead all beings to Nirvana, and in a matter as solemn as a vow, we cannot but take the words used absolutely literally, does seem a large responsibility for one individual to take upon him or herself. Beings of the past, the present, and the future, beings of all kinds, on all levels, of all degrees, that's an awful lot of beings to lead to Nirvana. Can this tremendous responsibility really rest on the shoulders of one individual? And if again we are to understand the vow, as we must, literally, then we have to imagine our bodhisattva undertaking a task that innumerable other bodhisattvas have already entered upon. Yet the vow is not, I shall collaborate with all bodhisattvas in leading all beings to enlightenment. How can it be possible for any one individual bodhisattva to fulfill his or her vow to lead all beings to Nirvana, unless all the other bodhisattvas stand aside, unless they stop being bodhisattvas? We can begin to solve this, perhaps, by trying not to take too literally the idea of the bodhisattva as an individual taking personal responsibility for the task. It is rather that the bodhisattva perceives that the highest need of all beings is enlightenment. This is his or her motivation. The bodhisattva sees the mess people are in, and perceives that the only real remedy for their plight is a spiritual remedy, and that the only person really qualified to help them is a bodhisattva. The bodhisattva identifies with this need of beings so clearly and completely that all his or her energies become devoted to its fulfillment. There is no energy left over to consider, I am doing this. It is this, as if you were present at some terrible accident, and seeing a lot of people badly injured, you are simply to throw yourself wholeheartedly into the practical business of helping them. Furthermore, it is not really possible to think of the bodhisattva's vow as an event separate from the arising of the bodhicitta. It might be said that the bodhicitta can be subdivided into two aspects. On the one hand, the vow, the bodhisattva's consciousness of the goal and his or her determination to realize it, and on the other hand, the actual steps to be taken for its realization, which means the practice of the six paramitas. The vow is an expression of the partially arisen bodhicitta functioning within a particular framework, or taking a particular direction according to the needs of sentient beings. At the same time, in a sense analogously, it has a disciplinary function, at least at first, when the bodhicitta is still relatively weak and embryonic. So it is at once expressive of the bodhicitta in a particular manner, and supportive of the further development of the bodhicitta. The implication of this is that the bodhisattva vow can be broken, the bodhisattva giving up being a bodhisattva, at any point up to the eighth bhumi, when the bodhicitta becomes irreversible. There are various references in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras to this possibility of losing one's vision, of getting fed up with beings. After all, there are an awful lot of them, and they can be very tiresome. There you are, trying to save them and lead them to nirvana, and they are simply not interested. They feel more at home wallowing in the miseries of samsara. So it can be quite frustrating being a bodhisattva. Indeed, according to the scriptures, this frustration might get the better of you one day and lead you to think, "Oh, away with all these beings." Then, in an instant, the bodhicitta would collapse and you would sink to the level of an arhat. In saying that, of course, we have to remember that by arhat we mean not the kind of person who would have been called an arhat in the early days of Buddhism, but the classical Mahayanist conception of the arhat, one who has seen through the notion of a self to the extent of perceiving that the so-called self consists only of dharmas, but who has not seen that these dharmas are empty. From the Mahayana point of view, this subtle sense of self, of being, whether with respect to oneself or to others, only disappears completely at the point of full enlightenment. Until then, there is always going to be some notion of self, however subtle, even for an irreversible bodhisattva. Otherwise, there would be no distinction between a bodhisattva, however advanced, and a Sangyak Sambuddha, a fully enlightened one. It is not always easy to step back a little from a text as profound as this and take what it is saying as a practical proposition. In the case of the bodhisattva vow, we may simply interpret it as being a matter of seeing the needs of beings very clearly and forming a wholehearted wish to devote ourselves to the fulfilment of those needs. It is a matter of beginning to overcome, or at least becoming more aware of, our almost instinctive, unconscious tendency to see people not in terms of what they need, but in terms of what we need from them, either practically, materially, or psychologically. A bodhisattva is galvanized to meet the very highest needs of beings. But we may start on the bodhisattva path not by thinking, "I shall lead all these beings to nirvana," but by resolving, "I shall try to see these beings as they are in themselves, and see what their needs are, rather than constantly looking to see how they can fulfill my own needs." This is the essential revolution called for by the bodhisattva vow. On top of that, it is just a matter of clarifying our vision until we really do perceive that what beings truly need is enlightenment. But here and now, in our practice of the metta bhavana, the cultivation of universal loving-kindness, we can work at developing goodwill to people irrespective of whether or not they are going to fall in with our own needs, wishes, or values. This is never going to be easy because we naturally feel our own needs much more strongly than we do those of other people. But we can practice thinking about other people's needs, how we can meet them, or if we cannot meet them ourselves, how we can help people to meet their own needs, even when we are also concerned with immediate, objective, legitimate needs of our own. It is not often that we see people just as themselves, rather than instruments of our own needs, and very rare indeed for us to put ourselves out for other people in a completely disinterested way. We might do it for our own mother or father, friend, lover or child, but mostly we look after number one. For monks and nuns there is a particular danger in this regard, inasmuch as they have left behind the natural and biological attachments which will draw the ordinary layperson out of complete selfishness. The danger of their monastic life is well illustrated in the Mahavagga section of the Vinaya, which recounts how the Buddha finds a monk suffering from dysentery and who is neglected by the other monks. When the Buddha asks why the poor fellow is not being looked after, the monks reply, "Lord, he is not useful to us." A dreadful admission. They are duly reprimanded, and even though in the Pali Canon there is no sort of mention of the Bodhisattva ideal as such, something like it, or the seeds of it, are clearly implied. "You have no father or mother to look after you," the Buddha says. As a member of a spiritual community, you do not belong to any natural group to the members of which you may look for help simply on account of the ties of blood. The help you give one another can only be motivated by a purely spiritual impulse, a feeling of common membership of a purely spiritual body. Caring for others on the basis of a spiritual motivation is much more difficult than caring for them out of a sexual or family interest. If your son needs a new pair of shoes, you may well be willing to put off getting yourself a new shirt, and this sort of thing has a maturing effect. So the danger of falling into selfishness and preoccupation is much greater for the spiritual community than it is for lay people with all their kith and kin to care for. The advantage of being a monk or nun is, of course, that you are able to avoid the often unconscious mutual exploitation that so often disguises itself as the caring and meaningful sexual relationship. There is, in fact, only one need of one's own that has to be fulfilled before one can preoccupy oneself effectively with the needs of others. And it is not a physical or material need, but simply a matter of emotional positivity and security. We need to appreciate our own worth and feel that it is appreciated by others, to love ourselves and feel that we are loved by others. On this basis, we can begin to develop the sensitivity and awareness to appreciate the real needs of others, not only their material needs or even their educational needs, but their need for an ideal to which they can devote themselves, a spiritual path they can follow. At the same time, the group of others to whom our concern extends can grow to include not only our own family and friends, but people beyond our own kind, race, gender, and even views. It can even include quite different classes of beings. If we are to make sense of what the Diamond Sutra is saying, having established a preliminary intellectual understanding, we need to keep coming right down to earth. Once we understand that it is desirable that we should devote ourselves to working for the spiritual progress of all beings, and that in order to do this we have got to think in terms of the needs of others rather than our own needs, we still have to go one step further back and realize that we need to get ourselves into a positive enough state to be able to start thinking about the needs of others quite naturally and easily. This is, as it were, the bottom line, and it is a bottom line that many people, and particularly those in the caring professions, might well examine. We have quite enough on our plate just at this level. The whole question of not having a notion of a being is one that we can probably leave in full faith to the future. In the meantime, we may consider that, insofar as we have some feeling for others and their needs, we are no longer seeing them as being entirely separate from ourselves, and to that extent we are no longer seeing them, having a notion of them, as beings in the sense of separate beings. Such a construction is fair enough to begin with, so long as we are clear that it is a long way, if we are going to take the idea literally, from not having the notion of a being at all.